Du staat von die Erd. Wie lang zurück hat's kein Erd gehabt, kein Leid, kein Helling. Es war alles just dunkel gewesen. Verstärkt damit hat Gott den Himmel und die Erd gemacht. Nur er gesagt, lass es Licht sein. Just wie soll was Licht gewesen. Gott hat's Licht da gekäse und's dunkel Nacht. Das war nur der erste Tag, als der Leben war. Den nächsten Tag hat er die Wolke gemacht. Er hat auch die Luft gemacht, so dass man schnaufen kann. Auf den dritten Tag hat das Land und das Wasser verdeelt. Er hat das See in die Himmel gemacht, alle Tag. Er hat noch gesagt, lass die Bäume ins Gras sterben wachsen. Und sie haben noch gestern wachsen.
That's the sound of Pennsylvania Dutch, a language spoken by the so-called Plain People, the Amish and the Mennonites. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Who are the Amish and the Mennonites? How do we sort through myth from fact in our understanding of Wisconsin's Pennsylvania Dutch communities? What should we know about Amish spirituality and culture? My guest this hour is Mark Loudon, UW professor of German and co-director of the Max Cotta Institute for German-American Studies. He's the author of the forthcoming book Pennsylvania Dutch, The Story of an American Language, and is a practicing Mennonite. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you very much.
It's fascinating to hear that language spoken because it sounds like almost German.
Yes, I mean, it is closely related to German, and the name Pennsylvania Dutch is a little bit misleading. The word Dutch in English, British English and colonial American English, actually referred to people from Germanic-speaking Europe. So that included folks from the Low Countries that we would associate with the Netherlandic or Dutch language today, but also German. And so, for example, if you read in like colonial era newspapers, they would talk about Low Dutch speakers, which could include Netherlandic speakers as well as Low German speakers versus the High Dutch. And those would be people that came from Central and Southern Germany, where the altitude is higher. Pennsylvania Dutch actually comes from the so-called High Dutch dialects or High German dialects. And it was brought to colonial Pennsylvania by about 81,000 settlers, of whom the Plain People, the ancestors of today's Amish and Mennonites, constituted about 5%. And the thing that's fascinating is that this is a language that developed from German dialectal roots, but really had no fresh input from Europe after the American Revolution. The American Revolution represented a break in European immigration generally, including from German-speaking Europe. And when large numbers of Germans came to North America again, starting like in the 1830s, 1840s, they really had no contact with the Pennsylvania Dutch, right? These sort of backwoods folks in rural Pennsylvania and then parts of Ohio and other bordering states with Pennsylvania who had developed this language that really was a sort of American product with German parts.
And is the, when you say Pennsylvania Dutch, is the Dutch a corruption of Deutsch then?
No, actually, no? The words Dutch and Deutsch are related to one another historically. Mm-hmm. But Dutch is the older English adjective to describe German.
German, okay.
German actually itself is a borrowing from Latin. And so the terms Dutch and German always existed in English side by side, Dutch being the more sort of folksy term to describe Germanic speakers from Europe, and German slightly more formal.
I know we're going to talk all about the Amish and Mennonites and stereotypes and so on, but let's stick with the language just for a little bit. Could you please read what you did at the opening, or a little more of it, and tell us, you know, what we're hearing?
Sure. This is an example of a Bible story for children. So it's essentially, it's not a biblical translation from the Bible, but it's a paraphrase of the Bible written by Amish people for Amish parents to read to their children. And the actual complete Bible has just recently been translated into the Amish variety of Pennsylvania Dutch. It's just completed a few years ago. This story that I'll be reading again is the creation story, so it's appropriate as the first story in the book.
That's why I was hearing Himmel for heaven
exactly,
and a few other things.
Exactly. So. And, you know, keep in mind that this is a language that has been cut off from contact from Germany for over 250 years, about 250 years now, and there's almost no... there are almost no English borrowings in this text. There are a few things that are what we call loan translations from English, but basically it's still a very, very Germanic language. It's not mutually intelligible with standard German at all. And as a matter of fact, for German dialect speakers from that part of Germany, which is what we call the Palatinate, not too far from the cities of Frankfurt and Heidelberg and Mannheim in Germany. Even when dialect speakers from Germany hear these words, they pick out a few things, but really don't understand the full text. And Pennsylvania Dutch is something where they recognize it as something that they should understand, that is familiar in some ways, but they don't. And I was just in Germany a few weeks ago, actually performing, singing and reciting Pennsylvania Dutch texts, and then kind of in between speaking in Pennsylvania Dutch. And, you know, these were all dialect speakers that were there. This was dedicated to sort of Palatine dialects in the larger world. And I saw a lot of blank expressions when I was speaking sort of in between. I said, do I need to slow down? They say, yeah, you need to slow down, and you need to throw a little bit more standard German in there for us.
Interesting.
But I'll read this text again. It's the title is Der Staat von die Erd, the start or the beginning of the earth. Wie lang zurück hat's kein Erd gehabt, kein Leid, kein Helling. Es war alles just dunkel gewesen. Verstärkt damit hat Gott den Himmel und die Erd gemacht. Nur er gesagt, lass es Licht sein. Just wie sel war's Licht gewesen. Gott hat's Licht dark gewesen und's dunkel Nacht. Das war nur der erste Tag, das Leben war. Der nächste Tag hat die Wolke gemacht. Hat die Luft gemacht, so es man schnaufen kann. Auf den dritten Tag hat das Land und das Wasser verdeelt. Hat der See in die Himmel gemacht, selle Tag. Hat noch gesagt, lass die Bäume ins Gras stärker wachsen und sie hin noch stärker wachsen. Auf der vierten Tag hat der Haar die Sonne, der Mond und all die Sterne gemacht. Der nächste Tag hat all die Fisch, Krebse, Whales und so Sachen gemacht. Der sechste Tag hat gesagt, es soll Vieh sein. Das war so Sachen wie Kieh, Geil, Hasch und Hase. Und sie war gewesen, erst wie gesagt hat. Gott hat gesehen, dass die Sache, was gemacht hat, all gut war. Nur gesagt, na, wollen wir Menschen machen. Sie sollen sein, so wie uns. Sie sollen schmerzen sein, als eines von den Vögeln oder Tiere und Fisch. Gott hat nur zum Staub genommen von der Erde und einen Mensch daraus gemacht. Und von dem Mann hat er einen Weibsmensch gemacht. Gott hat geguckt über alles, was gemacht hat, Kat. Es war alles ordentlich gut. In sechs Tagen hat Gott all die Sachen gemacht, die wir sehen können. Hat nur geruht auf den siebten Tag.
It's beautiful. Now, because I know the creation story, you can kind of start hearing and, you know, the days and the, you know, creation of this and that. It sounded as if there were some English words in there, like fish and sun and moon and water and so on.
That's because of the similarity between the German words to begin with. So the Pennsylvania Dutch word for sun is sun, which is the dialect form of Sonne. So sun and, you know, they're related. Mm-hmm. So the word moon is, in fact, also a German dialect word in that part of the Palatinate, and of course it's homophonous with English moon. Fish is totally homophonous, standard German, dialectal German, and English. But one bona fide loan word is whales.
Whales, I heard that
whales,
too.
Whales is out there too. And actually the very, very first phrase is a nice example of both a loan word that's been adapted to Pennsylvania Dutch pronunciation as well as a loan translation. The first three words are wie lang zurück. Wie is English way. Lang is German lang, but also English long, and zurück is back. So way long back.
So long ago.
Exactly. Wie lang zurück. And it's fascinating that you know, all Pennsylvania Dutch speakers have passive knowledge of standard German, but it's a form of standard German that's very archaic. So it's like the language of the Luther Bible. So similar to our familiarity with King James English, we understand it, but we recognize it's not something that's sort of everyday language. That's the limit to Pennsylvania Dutch speakers' familiarity with German. And so there are a lot of words that they have in their Pennsylvania Dutch that they just kind of assume, because they're pronounced like German and sound very much like German words, that they must have been German going way, way back. One of the first times I was at an Amish church service, which is going back 30 years ago, I was talking, this man used a word, he used the word Schule, right? And he said, ich bin nicht Schule, I'm not sure. And I said, oh, so that is English. I said, that's English. And he goes, no. He says, sure, that's English. Schule, that's Deutsch.
Okay. I get the sense you're passionate about Pennsylvania Dutch. Tell me why and what we would lose if this language died out.
Well, first of all, the language is quite healthy among the Plain people. And so we don't have to fear that the language will disappear among those folks. On the other hand, it is disappearing among the historical majority. We can talk about that in a moment. But I'm passionate about this language because it's really become a part of who I am spiritually as well as professionally. It was just over 30 years ago when I was a graduate student in upstate New York that I met an Amish family. And they had a bakery by the side of the road. And I stopped and we were chatting. And I was at that point looking for a church. I had not been raised in any particular church, had not been baptized. But I had visited a lot of different churches. And I felt drawn to the Anabaptist branch of Christianity, which includes Amish Mennonites. And so I was chatting with this family and I was, you know, talking about their church services, which are always held in homes. And they said, you know, church is at our house in 10 days. Why don't you come? And I went, and I was very nervous, but they had a chair reserved for me. I could understand things fairly well from the get-go, and also like during the sermons, the average church service lasts about 2.5 or 3 hours. And so you're, you know, it's a lot of it is just kind of sitting and listening. Listening to the sermon, which included a fair amount of archaic standard German vocabulary borrowed from the Bible, I could follow it fairly well when people were chatting among themselves. But what I really appreciated was that they did not switch into English for my benefit. So I was really immersed. And then that really got me going. And I eventually, it just, you know, like became sort of an every weekend type thing. I so-called ran around with the young people. I taught singing school for Old Order Mennonite youth in a couple of summers. Learned how to ride a horse and buggy, you know, lived with an Amish family for 5 years on a ranch in Texas, and eventually became baptized in the Mennonite church.
Well, let's talk about what the difference is between the Amish and the Mennonites, because presumably since you're a Mennonite, that's one reason you're able to be here on the radio drive a car and those other things. So there's obviously a clear difference, but, you know, they all trace back to the Anabaptists.
Yes. The Anabaptist movement was a somewhat decentralized expression of the Reformation. So there were a group of reformers that wanted to go a few steps farther than, say, like Luther and Zwingli and Calvin. And what kind of united the Anabaptists together in Switzerland, Germany, and the Netherlands was the belief that a baptism should be part of a conscious step that one takes as a believer to enter into covenant with God.
Rather than at birth,
right? Then was fighting words in early European history because church and state were totally linked with one another. If you have a number of children not being baptized, therefore not being registered with the government, then you don't know who your population is for taxation purposes, control, that kind of thing. So the Anabaptists were seen as, you know, heretical by church authorities and seditious by political authorities. The Mennonites became the sort of they were known as the followers of a man named Menno Simons, who was actually a Frisian former Catholic priest who became an Anabaptist, left the Catholic Church in the 15th century. The followers of Menno took the name, were called Mennists or Mennonites. Eventually, there were some believers farther south in Switzerland that felt that some of the believers of Menno were a little bit too progressive or a little bit too liberal in how they were living out their faith. And so there was a small kind of conservative split of mainly Swiss and southern German Mennonites off of the larger Mennonite branch, and they followed, clustered around a man named Jakob Amann. And so the name Amish comes from the followers of Amann. So by and large, there are really no major theological differences between Amish and Mennonites and a few other Anabaptist groups, but it's really sort of how it's all put into practice. Most Mennonites in this country are, you know, automobile driving, don't dress distinctively, use English in church, you know, have radios and televisions, that sort of thing. There are some Mennonites, including right here in Wisconsin, that are horse and buggy driving, but they have electricity, but they don't have radios. They have word processors, but they don't have computers that allow images. So there's all kinds of gradations in terms of lifestyle.
As there are with other faiths,
yeah. Exactly.
And would the Mennonites and the Amish be considered Protestant?
No.
But they are a split from the Catholic Church.
Right. If you define Protestant as sort of not Catholic, mm-hmm. That's true, but because mainstream Protestant churches, like, for example, the Reformed churches, so, you know, basically historically Calvinist churches, Lutheran churches, or the followers of Zwingli, because they all practice infant baptism still, that's still the big gap between the Anabaptists. So we're actually not considered Protestants. We're considered, you know, historically on the radical Reformation side of things.
And what's the relationship between the Amish and Mennonites and the Quakers? Because there seem to be some overlap with pacifism and, you know, a sort of different lifestyle.
Absolutely. They're very strong. I mean, the Quakers are a parallel development in England of what was going on in Germany. Also, the Baptists. I mean, if you think about Baptists generally, there were English reformers, and then also in Germany, those that practiced full immersion baptism that were similar. The Quakers are also a historic peace church, like the Amish, the Mennonites, the Brethren churches, which is also Anabaptist. So that we share in common. Also, during the colonial era, the Quakers were plain dressing. And many aspects of modern plain dress among Amish and Mennonites actually do trace back to the Quakers. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the bonnet, not the covering that women wear, the actual white sort of organdy material prayer cap that's referred to colloquially often as a bonnet by outsiders. It's actually not a bonnet. It's called a covering. That covering goes back to basically Central European women's head coverings. But a true bonnet, that like a sun bonnet that's typically black today for Amish and Mennonite women, that goes over the covering when they go outside, that, in fact, is taken from the Quakers. And what's interesting is that it was considered in the 19th century, it became popular among women generally, and it was seen as sort of a little bit too fancy, a little bit too fast, a little bit too stylish. And so some Anabaptists and some Quakers were saying, this has maybe gotten a little bit out of control here. But now, because no outside women wear bonnets anymore, it's considered sufficiently out of style that it's then appropriate for plain dressing Anabaptists to wear.
Can you give us some sense of numbers in terms of, you know, nationwide and also here in Wisconsin in terms of Amish and Mennonites?
The Old Order Amish number about 300,000 today.
In the United States?
In the United States and in Canada. In Ontario, there are Amish as well. That number is doubling every 20 years.
Because of the lack of birth control? I mean, they're stress on...
Birth control is not forbidden, actually, but okay. They choose not to limit family size. In most cases, they could if they wanted to, and for health reasons, some families do. But basically, on average, Amish families have between 6 and 7 children per family, and there's a very low attrition rate. So among the children born to Amish parents, between 85 and 90% will make the decision as young adults to join the Amish church. So it's a very high retention rate. The Old Order in Wisconsin has the fourth largest Amish population. The first two states are Ohio and Pennsylvania, very, very close to one another. Indiana is third and Wisconsin is fourth. And there are about 20,000 plain people, Old Order Amish, Old Order Mennonites, and a few smaller groups here in Wisconsin.
We're going to talk about some myths, some stereotypes, and what's really fact about the Amish and the Mennonites when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. The beginning of the Hymn of Praise, the second hymn sung at every Amish church service, and that's sung by my guest, Mark Loudon. I'm Emily Auerbach, and we're talking about who are the Amish and the Mennonites. Wow, that was very evocative. I heard the word father in there.
Right.
But it was such a long strung out. What did you actually sing there in terms of the lyrics?
It's a standard German text, and it was just the first line of this four-stanza hymn, which takes about 20 minutes on average to sing. O Gott Vater, wir loben dich. O God, Father, we praise you. And musicologists have studied these hymns. There have been a few field recordings that have been made with willing Amish informants. And the tunes all go back to familiar, generally Protestant, some Catholic church tunes that were, you know, used before the Reformation, then continued after the Reformation. The reason why the Amish and older Mennonites sing them so slow, there's basically no meter to it, right? There's a melody of sorts.
Yeah, it sounds like a chant.
Exactly. It sounds like a chant. And some people actually thought for a while that this must be some form of Gregorian chant. Mm-hmm. It's not, actually. If you sort of look at the transcription, you can identify the original melody. And in some cases in the Amish hymnal, which is the oldest Christian hymnal in continuous use in the world, they'll indicate the melodies that these texts are sung to, but there's not a single musical note in there. These are all tunes that have been passed down orally for hundreds of years now. The reason that they're sung so slow, and this is not an urban legend, this is actually a true story, is that in the earliest days of persecution of the Anabaptists in Switzerland, they had to meet in open fields. They sometimes met in private homes. Sometimes they met in secret. Other times they just gathered together in their homes on Sundays. And the greatest act of profanity that their suspicious and persecuting neighbors could direct toward them would be to dance to these tunes.
Okay.
And so even though they were hymns that everybody else was singing, because the Anabaptists were doing it, they wanted a way to really kind of, the neighbors wanted a way to sort of thumb their nose at them. And so they would dance to them, which was a majorly kind of profane act. And so what the Anabaptists did was they just basically started singing them slower and slower. And to this day, the slow tunes, as they are known, are preserved among the Amish and Older Order Mennonites in North America and nowhere else. It's been completely lost in Europe. This form of hymnody is only preserved here. And even within Amish and Mennonite groups, the range of conservatism of a particular group corresponds almost exactly to the tempo at which these songs are sung.
So the slower it's sung, the
more conservative
the
group. So for example, I say on average it's about 20 minutes for the hymn of praise that we just listened to the first line of. For a very conservative group, it could go on to close to a half hour for four stanzas. Then among other groups, it could be as short as maybe 15 minutes. And then there are more progressive Amish in the 19th century also sang these tunes to set them the texts to American gospel tunes. And so if you go to an Amish singing today, you'll hear them singing the so-called fast tunes, which are still relatively slow, but they're American gospel tunes from the 19th century that take these texts and are sung to it. And it's really very, very common for Amish young people to basically sing these old German hymns, but on their own, when they're just gathering among themselves, to the American gospel hymn. So it's something that's seen as like still fairly, you know, kind of low-key and nerdy by outsiders, but that's an example of how Amish young people do something that's maybe a little bit different than what they would hear in church.
And I understand you have a recording of some of the
I do, Amish yeah. I have a friend of mine, an Austrian ethnomusicologist named Thomas Nussbaumer, did some field recordings a few years ago in Iowa, came here to Madison, and we did a little sound salon and presented some of them. So we can listen to one.
Then tell me who are the children that we'll be hearing, and what was the context?
These are young people that were gathered for a Sunday night singing. When young people, Amish youth, gather together after the age of about 16 or 17, it's what's known as Rumspringa. A lot of misunderstandings about this in the popular media. A lot of people think that Rumspringa, which literally means running around, is a time when Amish young people, you know, drink beer, drive cars, smoke cigarettes, go wild, you know, party. There's a very, very small minority of Amish young people, youth, that do that kind of thing. Those are the ones that get the media attention and
course.
So forth. But the vast majority of kids are getting together and singing these hymns, basically. And so they gather on Sunday evenings, afternoons and evenings. Often we'll play games. If it's still nice weather and it's summertime, then they'll be outside playing volleyball or softball. They'll come in wherever the farm where they're being hosted will serve them a meal. And then it's usually at the farm where church had been held that day. And then they all get together and then they just sing. And then older folks will come too. So like the parents, you know, of some of the kids, because they like, you know, they sang all these songs when they were young too. And sometimes they'll sing English hymns as well. Generally, they won't sing secular songs at all. Every now and then they will, but not typically.
So this, and what will they be singing?
This is a German version, Wir ziehen nach dem verheißenen Land, set to the English gospel hymn, We'll Work Till Jesus Comes.
I picture this group singing, and then I'm automatically wondering, wasn't there an objection to being recorded?
This group in Kelowna, Iowa, was a little bit more on the progressive side, and with permission for musical purposes. Mm-hmm. Audio recordings are a little bit different from video recordings. Video recordings and allowing yourself to be photographed is something different, but audio recordings, more progressive groups don't have a problem with that. And as a matter of fact, if listeners are curious about, say, a good documentary on the Amish, mm-hmm. Public television, the American Experience series, 2.5 years ago, they made a documentary called The Amish, which had the cooperation of many Amish people under the condition that they would not be videotaped. But most of the narration on that is actually Amish people telling their story. And it's mm-hmm. not only a beautiful... It's not only an excellent documentary, it's a beautiful work of art as well.
Well, I already realized listening to you how little I know. You know, you think you know something because you read bits and pieces, you see the news stories, you have images of the Amish that show up in movies and in television. But it is a sort of stereotype. You know, I can immediately picture a man with black garments, a beard, driving the horse and buggy. The assumption is that he's going to be very patriarchal, keep his wife and family under close rule, and sort of shun the modern ways and sort of have this quaint rejection of everything that we associate with sort of modern life. Tell me what drives you nuts, you know, if this is your area, and both personally and also as a scholar, what kind of myths and stereotypes do you run into, or assumptions or ignorant statements that just drive you nuts?
I think actually related to youth, this in the so-called reality TV shows, things mm-hmm. like Amish Mafia, Amish in the City, Breaking Amish, this impression that somehow Amish youth are just chomping at the bit to sow their wild oats and go to, you know, go wild, go to cities and travel and so forth and so on. As I say, that's a very, very distorted view of Amish youth. And also this kind of at the other extreme that this somehow is this patriarchal, rigid society where nobody has fun and it's miserable and so forth. It's like almost like a cult. If life were that miserable, why would anybody choose to live it, right? And for the 10 to 15% of people born to Amish parents who make the decision not to join the Amish church, it's not for them, right? And generally what they do is go to a more progressive Mennonite church.
And right. then are they excommunicated or shunned?
They're only shunned if they were members of the Amish church, if they had been baptized members of the Amish church and had done something that was particularly problematic. Shunning is a form of church discipline that is not super common. And in most cases, it's always there's a possibility that the ban is lifted. And in any case, it's nothing like sort of scarlet letter, you know, I won't talk to you anymore, you're dead to me kind of thing at all. Essentially, every single Amish family has at least one or multiple close relatives who are not Amish. And blood is thicker than water on a lot of things. So if you go to, for example, a family reunion or a wedding or something like that, typically in the summertime, you know, you'll have from very, very conservative Amish folks to, you know, very progressive Mennonites or people that don't go to church or so forth. And so there's church discipline is definitely there, and there are certain rules that may not be broken. So, for example, divorce is not an option, right? But people know that going into baptism and marriage and so
forth. What if the wife is being beaten?
There are forms of working on, you know, like separating the couple. So there are situations where, like, let's say, and this has happened, where a woman or children have been physically abused by the father. And the first thing is to remove the wife and the children from the father, to move the father somewhere else. There are systems within Amish and Mennonite churches to address it, but they're also increasingly relying on outside help. So things like social workers in the rare instances where there is a substance abuse problems or mental health problems, there are actually institutions and almost like halfway houses and clinics that are run by more progressive Mennonites that help Old Order people deal with, struggle with these problems. But to sort of say, well, then just get a divorce, that would not be. Separation is possible. Divorce is not something that would be sanctioned. But obviously the interests of the victims, you know, still come first.
Mm-hmm. What about marriage outside of the faith?
Doesn't happen.
If it did, would the person be sort of dead to the family the way
No. I mean, they wouldn't make the decision as a young person, you know, as a young adult to join the Amish church if they had the intention to marry somebody that's not Amish. And often the decision to become a baptized member of the Amish church has happened after they've already been dating somebody who's Amish. And they're kind of, it's sort of the, it may not be very long after they both decided to get baptized that they will in fact then get married.
Is there a sort of implied judgment among the Amish that those who are from the outside world, the English, are, I guess, benighted, you know, that they're so cluttered and materialistic and distracted that they don't have as close a relationship to God?
Not really. The cardinal virtue in Amish society, if you were to ask an Amish person, they're not big on theology and doctrine and that kind of thing, but if you'll ask them, it's like, what's the sort of, you know, everyday concept that kind of God guides your life? And they would say humility, right? Demut. So it's like, I try to be humble. And humility means things like not interrupting people, not cutting ahead in line, not being, you know, demanding something of somebody else that's within the community with outsiders. And they see themselves as needing to be a light to others. They realize that there's a lot of attention on them. They realize that when they're out in public, people are watching them. And they say it's important to be sort of a silent witness, salt and light to the world. Humility is very, very important. Humility keeps their judgment in check. So this really struck me once. I was at a funeral of an elderly Amish woman near Bondwell, Wisconsin, some years ago now. And this was, you know, she was in her 80s, had lived a long life, had 13 kids, and, you know, a raft of grandkids and great-grandkids. I mean, by all accounts, had been just a really, really nice, you know, Amish mom and grandma and great-grandma. And, you know, the family was highly respected. And I remember the bishop standing, preaching over her open casket and saying, "We have a lot of hope for this woman. Men lot hoffning für die Frau." And what that meant was, you know, we're very hopeful that she's in heaven. But you would never say, this woman's in heaven, right? We know this absolutely. There's no so-called assurance of salvation. If they wouldn't even judge that for themselves or for really nice, healthy, wholesome people of their community who pass on, how could they presume to do that for outsiders? That being said, they also they feel that it's much easier to live a kind of healthy Christian life in a rural area versus in urban areas. As you said, things like clutter, distractions, technology, materialism. They see a lot of the trappings of modern life as kind of distracting from what they see as important, which is cardinal virtues of humility, avoiding pride. You know, taking, if they had to strip things down to like the most important part of the Bible for them, they would say, well, let's kind of look at the New Testament, within that, the Gospels, and then look at the Sermon on the Mount. What could be clearer, right? And so things like forgiveness, you know, loving your enemy. They say it's easy to love someone that you like. It's really hard to love someone in a Christian sense that you dislike, right? And so the bar is raised very, very high.
Forgiveness also seemed to be a very strong virtue. I remember after the massacre
in
2006, yeah. It seemed the sort of intent, purpose of forgiving even the most horrible enemies.
Yes, and that was reflexive. It wasn't done for show or anything like that. But you're referring to the Nickel Mines Massacre, which happened in October, I believe it was 2006, at an Amish parochial school in rural Pennsylvania, Lancaster County. A local man who was not Amish, had a wife and a couple of small children, was a milk truck driver, knew Amish people, you know, dairy farmers and so forth. He was obviously very mentally disturbed, went into the schoolhouse armed to the teeth, sent out the teacher, who ran immediately to a neighbor's and called the sheriff. There were a couple of mothers who had been visiting there, to sort of teacher's aides. All the boys were sent out of the room, too, and there were 10 girls left. He had the 10 girls stand up at the blackboard, and he shot them all. Five of them died immediately. The other five were wounded. Some were quite seriously. One girl is very severely disabled now from that. And all this happened within a matter of really within a couple of hours, everything was over. And after, you know, the Amish community coming together and sort of meeting the emotional needs of the families who had lost their children or had had wounded girls, then a group of Amish men went to visit the widow of the man who he had killed himself there and said, "We just want you to know that we forgive him and we hold nothing against you. And we would appreciate it if we could attend his funeral to pay our respects to him." Mm-hmm. They also went to this man's father, who was inconsolable. I mean, he was just howling. Mm-hmm. He felt so horrible. And this man also actually had Amish friends, right? Mm-hmm. And this one elderly Amish man just hugged him and said, "Don't worry, we forgive him and we forgive you." And this was picked up by the media. And this was something where, you know, the media actually got it right. And it was very, very striking. These were images and stories that, you know, made it around the world. And as I say, this wasn't something that the Amish did for show or for attention. This is just sort of an instinctive thing. And I was talking to a friend of mine who lives within a few miles of Nickel Mines. And she said, "That's what it says in the Lord's Prayer." And it's like, how can we expect forgiveness from God if we don't forgive other people? And it's easy to forgive people that do sort of little things, but something like this, this is really a test. This is a test of our faith. And no one would want to say that this was something that they would ever want as a test of faith. It was the worst massacre mm-hmm. ever perpetrated against Amish people in history. Many Amish people refer to it as their 9/11. But they say this is how your faith is tested. And there are stories of, you know, Christian martyrs going way, way back, you know, even to the days of the early church before the Reformation. They say this is just a long line of the struggles that believers have in this world.
We're going to talk about what happens when the Amish or the Mennonites come in contact with such organizations as the IRS, the Supreme Court, the medical system, the school system, all that, sort of the Amish today, when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with my guest Mark Loudon, and we are talking about who are the Amish and the Mennonites, including right here in Wisconsin. Here in Wisconsin, there have been some interesting legal cases, including the Yoder case about whether you could, you know, do homeschooling, whether, you know, what the rights of an Amish family were in regard to the public school system. There's all kinds of questions in terms of, you know, do they pay taxes? Do they have the right to go so slowly on a highway? Do they have to have that orange slow motion thing on the mm-hmm. back of the buggy? And what happens in terms of health care choices? Can you talk about some of the most important things for us to know in terms of the rights of the Amish coming in contact with all this sort of federal, you know, things that are there to protect the rights of children in particular?
Yes. There are, you know, a number of instances where Amish and Mennonites and conservative Mennonites have run in conflict with the law. Basically, there are very, very few exceptions that are made formally, like in federal law or state laws for Amish people. One thing about taxes is that Amish have to pay all taxes as everybody else does, so from sales tax all the way up to income tax. The only tax that Amish people are exempt from is the Social Security tax, only if they're self-employed or if they're working for another Amish person. So, for example, most of the Amish men in northern Indiana, which is a very large settlement, the Elkhart-LaGrange County area, they work in the trailer factories, mobile homes, making ambulances, that kind of thing. So they're working for non-Amish employers. They have to have Social Security taken out, even though they will not collect it.
Now, wouldn't working for motor vehicles be a bit of an ethical conflict?
No.
No, why?
Not at all. I mean, basically, it's a job. They do a lot of, economically, the vast majority of Amish families today cannot survive just by farming. They're not self-sufficient that way. And so they have businesses, and most of their clientele are non-Amish people. So it could be like, say, kitchen remodeling and roofing and even electrical work, right, for non-Amish people.
Gun shop?
All Amish people have, most Amish families have guns, but for hunting purposes. So they'll make gun cabinets, right, for gun, owners. But it's usually for other rural folks that use it, not for offensive purposes, but basically to go, say, deer hunting. They wouldn't do anything that would be in direct support of the military, right, during wartime. And so Amish young men, when there has been a draft historically, have been able to apply for conscientious objector status, which was only formally permitted after the Korean War. So it was really during Vietnam that there were large numbers of conscientious objectors among Amish and Mennonites, and most of them ended up doing so-called alternative service or voluntary service, which meant working in hospitals, mental hospitals, schools, that kind of thing for a couple of years instead of doing military service.
Well, and then what about the school rights? If you have Amish children in a one-room schoolhouse being taught certain things and stopping school often early.
Yes.
When does that come in conflict with sort of federal law about education for children?
There are really no federal laws that limit their parochial schools. And the Wisconsin versus Yoder case that you mentioned, the final decision came down in 1971. This was a unanimous decision, which is rather unusual in the Supreme Court, in favor of the Amish. And basically what they were asking for was the traditional Amish school ends at eighth grade. There were some state laws and local laws that mandated that children go to stay in school until age 16. So there were some eighth graders, who were finishing at age 15. And so basically the state was kind of using that state's individual states. Wisconsin was one, Iowa was another, where they said that they really didn't like the idea of large numbers of kids in rural areas not attending the public schools because that meant less funding from the state for those schools. So the Amish won the right to basically have their own schools. As far as curriculum goes, there are absolutely no restrictions whatsoever in the same way that there are no restrictions on really any parochial schools and homeschooling, that kind of thing. In 1971, it wasn't quite as common for example, homeschooling was practically non-existent. Nowadays, there are plenty of people that do homeschooling for a range of reasons, right? Political motivations, religious motivations, and so forth. Basically, the Amish are very much left alone, like most independent schools are today in homeschoolers. No one really bothers to, local districts don't bother to check up on what they're doing. But in some states, for example, in Iowa, the Amish school teachers voluntarily have their kids participate in standardized testing. And what they find is that they're scoring very, very high, especially in verbal arts, because they're very, very word-oriented. They're all bilingual. The schools are all conducted in English. And they don't have a lot of screen distractions, right? Mm-hmm. The only thing where Amish children lag behind is on standardized testing would be things like laboratory science.
I was going to ask you about science, in particular about the way science, evolution, things like that are handled within an Amish schoolroom.
Very similar to what you would find in conservative Christian schools. So evolution would not be taught. In some cases, there's not a science curriculum at all. But the idea is they say these kids know biology extremely well by growing up on farms, right? And they learn a lot of basic math and numeracy, not only from what they're learning in books, but also by helping dad with carpentry, helping mom in the kitchen, or helping mom with quilts. I mean, their numeracy skills are just through the roof compared to a lot of other people. But that's generally true of people that are constantly having to work with numbers anyway.
Well, and their skills are being put to use in a practical way rather than just in a textbook. I can see that. What about healthcare? Because that's often another area where religious groups can come in conflict. Can you refuse a blood transfusion for a child based on religious beliefs? Can you withhold medical care? You know, do faith healing and so on. What are the Amish beliefs and Mennonite beliefs having to do with health care?
There are no limitations whatsoever on forms of health care among the vast majority of Amish. So the blood transfusion issue, which is something that's associated with Jehovah's Witnesses, other sorts of limitations that are associated with, say, Christian Scientists, mm-hmm. those are non-existent among the Amish. The only restriction that comes from sort of a formal doctrinal perspective applies to a very, very conservative subgroup of Amish that are known as the Schwarzentruppers. There are Schwarzentruppers. They live mainly in Ohio, but there are some in Wisconsin, and some actually live fairly close to Eau Claire. And they've had some other kind of conflicts, not medical, but having to do with building codes up in Eau Claire County. The Schwarzentruppers do not allow for open-heart surgery because if you do this for an older person, like with a pacemaker or with a child, whoever, you actually have to stop the heart and put the patient on a heart-lung machine so that they can operate. The heart may not be beating during open-heart surgery. That, for the Schwarzentruppers, is seen as tantamount to basically playing God, right? Because the beating heart is something that's so, you know, core to life. To actually voluntarily stop that and restart it by using artificial means is something that's considered inappropriate. There have been a handful of cases of, adults, they can make whatever choices they want. But when it comes to children, for example, there have been a handful of cases where Schwarzentrupper Amish parents say that they will not allow their child to have open heart surgery. And in a few cases, doctors in conjunction with social services or, you know, children's advocacy, you know, state workers would file to get custody of the child, not to remove the child from the home, but at least to get permission to kind of override the parents' lack of permission so that the child may have open heart surgery. That's happened on a couple of occasions.
And in general, then, let's say that you're living in an Amish community in Wisconsin and you have a heart attack.
Yeah.
Do you go by ambulance to the hospital?
Absolutely. And it could be if it's an accident and you have to get, mid-flight to Madison, you can ride in a helicopter as well. There are absolutely no limitations that way.
But isn't that a kind of then hybrid approach to the whole electricity in modern life?
Because,
it's...
Absolutely. Because their relationship with technology is not a black and white one. It's basically what the sociologist Donald Crable has said, their bargain with modernity. So, for example, it's perfectly okay to use telephones, just not to own your own telephone that's actually physically located in your house. That's the compromise they make, because they say the telephone has all kinds of wonderful practical benefits with it. But if you have it in the middle of your house and it rings during dinner time or whatever, then it's a distraction. So they say, in the case of the telephone, we see it more as a tool, right? Like mm-hmm. a drill, right? It's something that's very, very handy, but it has to be kept within limits. Electric power from municipal sources is seen as something that's symbolically a tie to the outside world. But at the same time, they'll get LP gas, right, from the gas. So they know that they're dependent on the rest of society. But a lot of what they do are really less for kind of practical reasons and certainly not for like biblical injunction reasons, but simply for kind of symbolic traditional reasons. And so for them, it's, they say, to own or operate our own vehicle is different from, say, hiring a driver to take us to Walmart this weekend for shopping purposes. They say if it's just unhandy enough, then people won't abuse the benefits that come with riding in a vehicle. So, for example, I have some friends that are horse and buggy Mennonites, and there's a very closely related church here in Wisconsin, a denomination that is in full fellowship with them, but they actually drive black automobiles. So they're known as the Black Bumper Mennonites. And the Black Bumper Mennonites, own their own vehicles and actually do some driving for their horse and buggy relatives. And this one horse and buggy Mennonite guy told me once, he said, their barn raisings just aren't as good as ours are, because it's like too many people have distractions to say, I'm going to Eau Claire to do this, or I'm going to drive to the cities to do that. He said, when things are made just a little bit unhandy, just a little bit inconvenient, that kind of builds community spirit. And that's the way that they really look at it.
I assume they use heat, though.
Yes, absolutely.
In the winter. I think there was something I read recently about the power lines, voltage lines, and whether they could go through Amish land.
Yes, this was the Badger Coulee Transmission Line project that I was a consultant for with a grassroots group. And there were kind of two suggested routes for this high voltage power line, which will link Holman just north of La Crosse to Madison. And one was a little bit longer and a little bit more expensive to build, would have followed mainly the I-94 corridor, which was the preferred one. But the sort of, as the crow flies, straight from Holman to Madison went right through Cashton. Cashton in that area of, the Kickapoo Valley of Wisconsin has the largest Amish settlement. And so not only Amish people were upset about the idea that a 150-foot swath of land would be denuded so that these high-voltage power lines would be put through, but the neighbors did as well. I mean, this was a community thing. Nobody wanted this in their backyard. And so there's obviously something symbolic about the fact of having not just power lines, but high-voltage power lines, right, cutting, a path through your farm with potential negative side effects of stray voltage and these kinds of things, and the concerns about, say, maintenance workers coming on Sunday, to fix repairs, to make repairs on the lines and so forth. So symbolically, it was kind of, not something that they wanted. But practically speaking, they recognize that they are living in a society where, their neighbors will have automobiles and, they'll see satellite dishes on their neighbors' things, and they know that there are signals going across their property the whole time. But they say it's not about sort of banning things completely and trying to live absolutely cut off from the rest of society. It's really just kind of striking these bargains.
Would you say that within the Amish community today, there's an embrace of any kind of diversity in terms of, let's say, musical styles and the arts, cuisine, et cetera? Is there or is it sort of trying to keep things a bit uniform?
Cuisine, absolutely no limitations whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I mean, Amish love food. Amish cooks are amazing. Both men and women, baking all kinds of things. I mean, it's interesting because in Pennsylvania, it tends to be a little bit more traditional and conservative. So in the Midwest, they're a little bit more, they've been influenced more by sort of general Midwestern dietary norms. But, many enjoy going out for Chinese food. Mexican food is very, very popular. Some will actually try and make, Mexican or Chinese dishes at home. There's absolutely no limits on food whatsoever.
And what we can do is go out on another song that you brought that kind of illustrates that. And so let me first thank you. My guest has been Mark Loudon. We've been talking about the Amish and Mennonites, especially here in Wisconsin. So thanks for being my guest and being very enlightening. Tell us what we're going to listen to as we go out.
Yeah, there's a man named John Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-D, who is from Berlin, Ohio. And he's not Amish, but he grew up among Amish people and learned to speaks absolutely perfect Pennsylvania Dutch. Married a woman who grew up in an Amish family but didn't join the Amish church, and they're Mennonites now. And this guy is a folk singer. He's known as the Pennsylvania Dutch Johnny Cash. And Amish, when they listen to popular music as young people or even older people, love old, like bluegrass, kind of acoustic guitar, that kind of thing, kind of old country. So like music maybe going up through Loretta Lynn and Conway Twitty in the 1960s, it was very, very popular, but like traditional bluegrass and folk songs. And so what John Schmidt does is he goes to, especially in the summertime, to places where, like fairs and so forth, where, some Amish people may be, or to Sarasota, Florida, which is the sort of Amish snowbird haven or whatever in Florida, and in winter, and he's traveling there, and he'll perform, and a lot of Amish people will go there, and because he's a Mennonite, he speaks excellent Pennsylvania Dutch, they're happy to listen to his music, and so we'll listen to one of his songs that he's performed. This is from Shipshewana, Indiana, a live concert that he gave.
Wussen unser Brüder, wir lieben so viel, und für was verlassen sie uns? Sie sind da drüben, wo alle Gott loben, sie kommen nicht wieder zurück. Sie kommen nicht wieder zurück. Sie kommen nicht wieder zurück. Sie sind da drüben, wo alle Gott loben, sie kommen nicht wieder zurück.